I think we can do this in English for once. And it's nice because the people of Portugal or whatever who can then listen to it in English. So it's Saturday, February 17th? Yeah. Was yesterday or the day before, maybe yesterday, I was reading, I read two things almost simultaneously, one after the other, consecutively. One was an email from a literary magazine that I sometimes contribute to. And it was saying that submissions were open. You could send work. And it said, so poetry, you could send this many poems, and prose, this much, And then there was another one saying, for work that does not wish to be defined, or that is hybrid, you can send it in this category and this much, this quantity. And then after that, I'm on the mailing list of the New Yorker. It was in the magazine. I'm a subscriber to the New Yorker. And there was an article about something like the issue of how sexual assault is dealt with on college campuses or something like that. It's a big issue in the U.S. these days. And there was a story about a woman, a person, let's say, whose name was Teresa something, at Columbia, a big university in New York, who had been assaulted, and the university didn't follow through with prosecuting the person because there was a question of whether there was consent or not, all these issues. Anyway, but this woman is a performance artist, and she has continued pursuing it, and she, for the 5 years she was in Columbia, she's no longer at Columbia, she dragged around an extra large mattress to all of her classes, every place she went, as a protest until the university would prosecute this person who had. And other people began joining this protest too and took to carrying mattresses around the campus. And it became kind of a performance art protest statement or something. Anyway, so they were talking to this person, Teresa, whatever her name is, and in parentheses it said, Teresa self-identifies using the collective pronouns they and them. So the rest of the article, I didn't read the whole thing, but I read a few more paragraphs. It was very confusing because it was, they said this happened to them, or them, or they wanted this to happen, or it was very confusing. And
they was her.
Well, but not her. It's this person, yes. She didn't want to be identified as her or him or she or he, but as they. So what I extrapolate from this was that they was self-identifying as multiple possibilities, as not just a he or a she, or not he and she, but as they, something like that. Although the name was Teresa, and it was clearly, it was a woman who was trying to have this guy prosecuted for rape, whatever, a man. And anyway, so I didn't read the rest of the story, so I don't know what ensued from that, but it is considered one of the key cases. It's involved in Colombia has a big problem with it or something. What interested me was that I had these two instances of defining the self, or self-defining, or defining a piece of art, or defining how I want to be seen or heard or whatever, that came one right after the other. And I started thinking, maybe I had already been thinking about definitions and how we limit ourselves by definitions, and how the definition of who we are, whether it be gender, age, color, race, religion, level of education, bank account, all of that, it has really nothing to do who we truly are. And however, we are very identified with these definitions. And I started, so I had been thinking about this already, and these two cases, I found intriguing to what extent, what does it mean that we do these things like that? And it felt like in both cases, it was just creating another category of identification and being limited by another category. So there's this hybrid category of work for this magazine, which does not want to be defined, but it's giving itself a definition by saying it's hybrid or not defined. I understand totally the motivation of the magazine, and I understand that the writers who are doing this understand what is behind it, and I think I understand this woman, this person, I'll say woman, this person, her intention with choosing to be identified as they and them. Because I think we all, in a sense, can relate to that. We are multiple. You know, we're not just he or she, and we're not just a student at Columbia who is a performance artist and, you know, was born in Seattle and works at a coffee shop and whatever, you know. We are all multiple, so I understand, I think, the intention. Although it didn't go into details. It's so funny, the New Yorker, though, because they try to be so... Do you ever read the New Yorker? You do too sometimes, no?
Sometimes.
No. They try to be so... meticulous, and there's so much fact-checking, and the grammar that they... It's like so, so perfect. And it almost made me laugh out loud when I saw this thing in parentheses. Teresa chooses to be identified as they and them. And then they continued to use that in the sentences, which was so cumbersome and so strange. That it almost defeats the purpose of what the person is trying to do, maybe, I don't know. It makes the person someone exceptional and unusual when perhaps that's not what is the point. I don't know what her point is, actually. So, all these definitions. And then this happened at the same time as 3 days in a row. First, I think it was Wednesday when Joa said that the mother of a friend of his had just died. Right? Mm-hmm. It was Wednesday, you told me. And you said it was weird because you had just talked to her not long before or something about her mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something like that.
I saw her mother. I saw her mother in December, and I spoke with her like 24 hours before.
Right. Exactly, that was it, yeah. So there was that, this person who dies. And then the next day, I received this email early in the morning announcing that this colleague, friend, had died the day before. And that night, Thursday night, I had dinner with a friend, and he was telling me how... about some difficulties in his family, and that his mother-in-law was very, and I know his wife's, and I had met his mother-in-law at their wedding, you know, 4 years ago. And so he was telling me about his mother-in-law and about how she's not doing well, and that the nieces and the nephews are pestering my friend's wife because they want their part of the... They have a house, big, beautiful house in the country, and they want their part of it. And his wife keeps saying, well, my mother's not dead yet, and you know, whatever. And the next morning, my friend sends me an email saying, my mother-in-law died last night. So there were these three situations. Boom, 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 three people who died. It's not unusual. People die all the time, right? At this very moment, someone is dying. Multiple people are dying. However, there are moments in our lives when suddenly we meet it. And it's not something that we all meet every day, unless we work with dying people, or we work in a hospital, or maybe a retirement home, or something like that. Otherwise, most of us are not encountering death regularly on a daily basis in our entourage, you know, in our intimate or even a bit larger circle. So that was, it was a bit unusual for me to 3 days in a row have three. I didn't know, I only knew one. Well, I had met two of the people. I knew one very well, and the other one I had no idea who she was. But Joa did. So, anyway. And so I was, as I was thinking about these definitions, and I was thinking, how did these people who died define themselves? And this woman, who the mother-in-law, who had this beautiful country house where she lived. No, she didn't. Initially, she lived in Paris, but it was her family's home, and she lived in it. But as we say, she didn't take it with her, the house. She died like she was born, naked and poor, which is how we all are born and how we all die. Right? We don't take any of the definitions with us, and we are not born with any of the definitions. Of course, immediately when we are born, yes, there is the family gives a name, and we become part of that family, and we become associated with the social, economic, cultural situation in which we are born. And we then become identified with that, and it has an influence on then where we go to school, and if we go to school, and what work we will have, whatever. But ultimately, we will return to dying naked and poor. Poor being not a judgment, it just means not having anything, which is actually the truth of our life all the time. We have this belief that we have things, and we identify very much with the clothing we have, and the clothing being more than just this, but it's the car and the house and the job and the friends and the lovers and the whatever it is, accomplishments, bank account, whatever. But none of that is actually the living experience of the reality of the self and life. We have a Zen saying, koan, that is, better to have nothing at all than to have something good. Because as soon as we have something good, I mean, this is a very simplistic way of explaining this koan, but as soon as we have something good, then we've set up a multitude of separations and divisions of what's good and what's bad, and that's only the beginning. That's only the tip of the iceberg. And we will then have to, we will want to keep it, what is good. And we will then function in a way that takes us away from just being here now with what is, in order to maintain this something good, in order to hang on to it and keep it away from other people. And then we will immediately think that someone else has is better, and we will then want that. There's an image I read in a book once about, maybe it comes actually from some ancient Buddhist sutra, I don't know, but it was in a Zen book, that actually the way that we function in our deluded way, it's like the image of a bowl of sugar with ants in it. And the ants, the way we function in our consumer Western society, which unfortunately is far moved beyond the West, but ants in a sugar bowl. And so the ants are just feasting on this sugar, and their bellies fill with it, and they don't know anything in the bowl is such that the only thing they know is the sugar. And they become intoxicated with it, and the only thing they can do is to keep taking more of it. And it's tragic, because that is the way that we function. This is a collective we, I'm meaning this culture in which our culture functions this way. More sugar that takes us away from, and not just sugar, but I'm using sugar in a large sense, of entertainment, distraction, anything that will help us deny the naked, poor truth of who we really are. And naked and poor in this sense, it's not negative. I'm not passing a judgment on this and saying this is poor me, this is a destitute state we're in, and we're trying to deny it. We think that it's bad because we are in this thing of having something good. And so we think that being naked and poor is the absolute worst thing possible. And we therefore need to have more sugar, accumulate. And it's a vicious circle, because the more that we feed ourselves the sugar and the distraction, the more we remove ourselves from the reality, and we lose sight of it, and the only thing we see is the sugar and the distraction. More, I'm simplifying this greatly, but I think you can understand. Just in our own lives, we see how we do this. You sit down and you watch a series, like Mad Men, and it's like binging, you can't stop. You just watch one episode after the other until, it's midnight, I gotta go to bed. When there would be the temptation to almost watch one more episode, even though you know you have to go to bed, because you have to be up early in the morning. And you know that when I'm talking about myself here, I know that when I watch whatever it is, Mad Men is not so violent and whatever, but whatever it is that I'm watching right before I go to bed, it like lives on in my head and disturbs my sleep. And they say that it's a good idea not to look at screens within X amount of time before you go to bed, right? Does anyone know? Mm-hmm. Have you heard that? What? Yeah. And yet, we do it. People do that with eating, drinking, anything, Think of all of the stuff we do in our lives that takes us away from being naked and poor, and there's a lot. And living according to these definitions, like attaching and identifying with definitions, is just another way of distancing ourselves from who we truly are. Because who we truly are has nothing to do with those definitions. And the definitions may keep us in a position where we're always defining ourselves according to someone else or something else outside of ourself. And that will always fail in the sense that it will never be enough. We will never be good enough. We will never be true enough. We will never find our own stable position, roots, as long as we are depending on something or someone outside of us. We do it all the time. You know, we do it in terms of work, family, income, study, emotional, psychological identity. And it becomes almost schizophrenic in a sense. And I'm not talking in like the pathological psychiatric definition of schizophrenia, but something that is similar in that is that we are not living from or in the reality. We are living in a projection and fantasy of how of what we think it is or how we like it to be. And we do this as individuals, but society does it as well. Now, of course, it's not, you know, I don't want to, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not going to go into the pathology of schizophrenia, but I'm using that word in that sense because it's, you know, there's this dichotomy between things as they are and things how we would like them to be, or how we project or fantasize. So what do we do then? By coming and sitting on your cushion like this, this is already, when you're sitting there on your cushion, that's already, we say that Zazen, Zen meditation, is the living the reality of things as they are. It is. Of course, we have stuff going on in our head, and we're not paying attention as much as we might to this reality of things as they are, but it's already an attempt, and there's a possibility in that, in this sitting, to experience it. That's what we train in. That's why we call it a training sometimes, or a practice. We practice doing that so that we can have this experience of things just as they are, of the self. Now, I'm not going to get into the big definition of what the self is, but when you meet it, you will know it. There will be no doubt. And it's not who you think you are. It's not what you think you are. You know, it's kind of like something like candle or fire. So we have an image of it, fire. We can study the scientific properties of it. We can study the origin of it. We can watch it. We can make a fire. We can put logs in the fireplace. We can light the candle. We can call it fire. We can draw pictures of it. We can take pictures of it. We can read about énormes incendies and, you know, forest fires and the destruction, whatever. But that is not the same. That's not fire. That's definitions, explanations, pictures, images, projections of fire. But that's not fire. And even the word fire is not fire. If you put your hand in the fire, then you have a direct experience of fire. And it doesn't matter what you call it. You can call it fire, you can call it fogo, you can call it, what do you say in Portuguese?
Fogo.
Huh?
Fogo.
Oh, yeah, fogo. I don't know that one. Yeah, I'm sure there's, in every language there's words for fire. Doesn't matter what you call it. There's that. You put your hand in the fire and you experience fire direct. You know, I was thinking fire and I think of that Bruce Springsteen song, Fire. That's not fire. that the name of the song is Fire, and I can hear him singing the song, and it's a great song, but it's not fire. And the same thing is true of me, of you, of us, of this self. So we define it, then we categorize it, then we try to describe it and
understand it
exactly, make it into something, project it out, all this stuff. And yet, that's not it. That's not it. And when you have the experience of it, I say there's no doubt because it's so obvious. And suddenly, all the rest of everything, all the attempts at defining it are like, really? Really? What? And that changes everything then about the way that the self is in the world. It doesn't actually change the way that I'm saying this. It doesn't actually change the self in the world, but it changes the way that we experience the self in the world, let's say. It changes the way we experience the world. The world doesn't change. The self doesn't change, but the way that we experience it does. I also read somewhere about like one of these past days, I can't remember what it was, but someone who had nearly died, maybe someone who had a bad accident or something, whatever, and had said that it was really, really seductive, the call to die. It was someone who was like seriously injured, I think, or seriously ill, whatever. Very like, you know, touch and go near death. And had said that it was really just an amazing thing to like want to go. And had for some reason decided that no, and I don't remember exactly the details, had decided that no, it wasn't the time or something, and managed to be alive and tell the story. I don't remember what it was. But I can imagine, I can't imagine it because I don't know it, but when I hear that, I think, yeah, there must be something to that, you know, that because I know the experience of naked and poor. I know the experience of the true self. And I imagine, when I hear this, it was such a seductive thing, that there's something really, there's a moment when it shifts and it's like just letting go. And that is such a fabulous thing, just letting go. Of course, I'm not even going to begin to go there and say what death must be really like, because it's not where I am, you know. But I can understand that that is possible. And I also can understand the resistance to that. And I can understand that they say that everyone, that death involves an ultimate letting go, and that everyone at some point does let go. But what that means for those individuals, for each person, we don't really know. But there is a letting go at some point. So the question is, by the letting go of the identities and the definitions of self, that's already a kind of death. That's already dying, in a sense. And some people say, I read that somewhere, that ultimately, in order to live a full life, you have to die before you die. Mm-hmm. You know? That if you don't, you will constantly be in this separation and projection, and you need to, this letting go is a kind of death. Now, of course, there's different degrees to that, and different how we define that, what that means, that death. It doesn't mean we disappear. It's like that Confucius saying of we have two lives. The second one begins when we realize we only have one. So that's the kind of, that's the moment of death, when we realize, oh yeah, there's only one. You know, sometimes in Christianity they talk about being reborn, you know, reborn Christians and reborn. But it's the same thing. It's just, I'm assuming, I don't know exactly what the rebirth thing is about in the reborn Christians, but I think it's a similar kind of thing that happens where suddenly we have this realization. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, it's not about finding God or something like that. It's about finding oneself. And it's not about waking up to the existence, the experience of an entity, an all-powerful entity outside of me, au-delà, you know. It's about waking up to this, here, now, in me. Sometimes I think we can say that it's the same thing, that it's just a formulation, but that formulation changes everything. When we start having theistic, monotheistic with gods and, you know, higher beings and things. But even when I say I hesitate even to say the Buddhist tradition, because as soon as we have an ism, we start having problems. This Buddhist magazine that I write for is in a moment of transition because the editor is resigning and there's a question of like what we should do with it, you know, how can we get it better distributed, how can we find readers, whatever. And they approached a woman who, the owner of the magazine and the current editor, approached a woman who's quite well known in France, who works for France Télévisions, and used to run this program on Sunday mornings, it's called Les Voix Bouddhistes or something. Each religion in France has like 15 minutes on Sunday morning, and they invite people to come. And so this woman was in charge of that, and she used to do the interviews and everything. And now it's someone else who does it. But so she's quite well known, and she works at France Télévisions. I don't know what else she does, because she doesn't do that program anymore. So they approached her and asked her if she would be interested in taking over the magazine, being the editor of the magazine. And so she had long discussions with them, and one of the first things she said, they told me, was, well, first of all, you have to change the name because Buddhism is over. And then she had this whole thing about, you know, she wanted a marketing strategy and she wanted to do a marketing survey, which is a good idea, actually. And all of this stuff she wanted. But it was the thing of Buddhism is over that struck me, and I think all of us, we kind of laughed. Because what she is saying, and I think they approached her for that reason in a sense, is that for her, of her understanding, Buddhism as a marketable product is over. In the sense of, now people want well-being, happiness, mindfulness, other products. And so she was coming from a commercial marketing point of view, which is in a sense why they approached her, because they were trying to expand the market and find something that would appeal to people and whatever. And so she was just doing what they asked her to do. And the name of the magazine is Regard Bouddhiste. I'm not saying it's a perfect name and it could perfectly change, but it was the notion that Buddhism is over. And I think she even said it in English. The Buddhism is, say, over or something like that. And so, okay, Buddhism is not over. What maybe the ism at some point will be over, but what it is, the experience that it is pointing to, is not over, and will never be over. What the original person who, I mean, he was not a Buddhist, the guy who sat down and came up with what we all still do today, he was not a Buddhist. So it has nothing to do with Buddhism, in fact. You can call it, in a sense, whatever you want, you know, a rose by any other name, or a rose is a rose is a rose. But at the same time, like the person who wants to use they and them as an identity, if we start changing names and things, it's just another identity. It's just another label. So, what do we do? I hesitate, as I just said, I hesitate sometimes to use the word Buddhism because I know people have so much association with that, and that name Buddhism really doesn't have anything to do with my experience of self and the reality of life. I know that other people who my teacher and her teacher and, you know, the whole lineage have that same experience. And that's why I do what I do, not because it's called Buddhism or because it's called Zen, because it has that name. And I know that when I read or am told what the original person who started this whole thing experienced, that's my experience. And I don't care if it's called Buddhism or not. That's my experience, and that's why I do what I do. At the same time, and this, you know, may seem like a contradiction, just in my own story, was I wanted other people who were doing the same thing I was doing, and we do too, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here, and I wanted some form and container in which to, a vehicle by which I could practice this and share it with others. And if that meant then finding a label, a container, you know, by definition has limits and definitions. You know, so I felt the need for that, in order to share and practice with others. But it's not limited to that. And you could change the name, or other people who use the same name for what they do, I don't relate to that, what they do. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's not because they call it Zen that it's what I do. Let's say something like that. That we do, and we all have experienced that too. You know, there are people who are, maybe Islam is a really good example too, because there are people who claim to who give themselves the label of Islam and to be Muslims, and yet they don't practice at all what the vast majority of people who are practicing Muslims practice. And I'm using the example of the Islamic terrorism. It's not because it has that name that it's what it is, and that's not the experience of it. What's important is our experience, our life, our direct experience of who we are and what is here now. And that's what the original guy, Shakyamuni Buddha, said. he wasn't the only one who ever said that. And he's not the only one who ever experienced that. And people in other traditions or people in no traditions experienced that too. He just formulated a container, let's say, through which to share it and experience it that appealed to people. Anyone have any?
Since you mentioned the first story about the article, I was thinking of something I've heard on the radio yesterday. They interviewed an Israeli professor, I think a sociologist or philosopher, who published a book. And he mentioned something that really puzzled me, and I haven't really kind of thought about it, but he was talking about the self and the culture, and at some point he said, over 30% of people identify as a minority. And he concluded, 30%, over 30%, it's not a minority anymore. And I thought I was very puzzled by that comment on the figure. So the first thing that I thought was, well, I mean, you might always feel, if you look, you're always a minority about something, probably. You know, like I'm a gluten allergic, so I'm part of that minority of people who are gluten allergic, or I'm part of the people who have, you know, no hair, or I'm part of the people who have that gene, or so of course obviously you know. But when he said, you know, oh, then it's not a minority anymore, it felt like it denies something about who I am. And behind that, I was thinking of the violence very often, like people identify as a minority because there's a violence against them. Women against, I don't know, the blacks or the Jews or whatever, being gay or like, you know, gender, it could be anything. So there is a violence. And then I keep thinking of that documentary that I saw about Native Americans fighting in the Dakota against the Dakota pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I saw a documentary and I was very moved by it. And so there is something, part of me that I feel completely, I can feel the whole history and the pain behind it and the state violence against it and the injustice and then I was also see the pain that it is to be identified about of something, and I was like, part of me was like, well, why don't you just drop the identity? But it's also very important. Like, I know how the suffering that it is to be identified with something. But I feel it would be very unjust to say, you know, drop your identity. I mean, forget about being Native American and identify with it. Just, you know, it's like, forget about that. But I think there's maybe the resolution is that the fact that there is violence, that someone is trying to impose that you should drop your identity. And that violence is like, the fact that you drop yourself, your identity, is something very different than someone pointing out to you. It's like, not only you cannot even get out of that category, or you should get out of that category. You're gay, shouldn't be gay, or whatever. You know. So I'm a little bit, you know, a little bit puzzled with that. At the same time, the importance of, like, the Native Americans, that they should be free to be Native Americans. Yeah, Native Americans, Native Indians. Native Americans, right? Indians. And yet, the suffering that it is personally to be stuck with one identity. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something like... it's part of the same problem, I'd say, when it's presented like that, because if we... There is diversity, right? In fact, we're all a minority of one, you know. Everyone is a minority, and therefore there are no minorities or majorities, because everyone is different. Diversity is limitless. And to then not acknowledge that diversity becomes totalitarian or fascist or... It's ignorance, right? To want everyone to be the same, or to pick and choose, and as we say this during the Auschwitz, of these people are valid and these people aren't. You know, this identity is valid. So, if you're a gypsy, if you're a Jew, if you're a communist, if you're gay, if you're handicapped, then those people were all killed. So basically, all you could be was a Christian white. Young male.
Blonde. Straight.
Straight. Right. Straight. of Aryan descent. Of course, that's pushing it to the limits. But as soon as we start making these distinctions and saying this identity is good and this identity is not good, we're still in the position of identity. However, the reality of life is this diversity. So, okay, the reality is, yes, there's someone who is Native American, and there's someone who is African American, and there's someone who's... America is, like, such a weird place because no one was there originally except for the Native Americans. Everybody else is an immigrant. And yet we have this whole thing with immigration, and everyone chose to be there except... Everyone chose to come there, except the blacks, the African Americans, who were forced to come there. No, so it's such a strange place. In that, and people, even as we know as Americans, when you're a kid, kids are always saying, "Oh, I'm Irish. Oh, I'm German. Oh, I'm Swedish. Oh, I'm German on my mom's side, and I'm Welsh on my father's." You know, it's just weird stuff. And when my daughter first went there, she was like. People would say, "Oh, I'm German." She was like, "You're not German."
that's how I felt when I went for the first time.
I'm sure you
did. Right. I was like,
she was saying that?
No, people would say that to her.
To her?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to belong to a group.
Exactly, right.
You're something.
And so you say that you're Irish or something, but you're not, actually. Anyway, so the notion of at the same time, people identify with those communities, and there's, you know, the huge Polish community in Chicago, and there's the Irish community in Boston, and even in Chicago too, the Chicago River, they dye it green on St. Patrick's Day, you know, it's a big thing. These are just identities, though, that people have, and they perpetuate, and they really don't even mean anything anymore. A lot of the American Jews are fiercely pro-Israel, and yet they have no clue what's going on in Israel. I mean, really, what the on-the-ground situation is, you know. And so telling someone that they should let go of their identity is just the same thing as identifying with the identity, you know, in that sense. I'm not sure. So people have been telling the Native Americans that they should let go of their identity?
No, not at all. No, they should get out of and accept the Dakota. But ultimately, that also means, yeah, in a sense, you know, we don't want you to live the way you want to live. Also, know, you don't have that land doesn't belong to you anymore. Right. We're going to pollute your water, but it doesn't matter because it's not your water anymore, and et cetera, et cetera. So that means you're actually exerting violence against the possibility for them to exist the way they want to exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's another way of totalitarian
imposition of... Right. So there is something about actually, you know, state violence, and state violence being also just the way, I mean, the way social, I mean, from the point of view of a state organization that we organize ourselves by, you know, you need to tick, you know, if you like, if you want to go to university, which part of, and if you say you're like, you're Latino, then you probably have more chances to go to that university because you're going to go into that program of
affirmative action,
positive discrimination. So it's like it has huge consequences, but that's violence. I mean, it's in a way, it's like,
because
yeah,
our whole culture is built on that,
right,
on differences, on,
right,
on so focusing this is, on the identities.
Right, this is why I feel there's something that it's very violent when it comes from outside, because it pushes you in, it forces you to identify yourself, and it's something very different from like the internal process of seeing that your identity is just,
so the thing
forget
is,
the self.
Can we, because I, you know, I often give this example of, okay, I'm going to take the plane and I'm going to go to Chicago. If I show up at the customs, you know, and where I have to show my passport, and I say, I don't have fixed identity, they will not let me go through. You know, you have to have this passport that says this is who you are and this is your
and
age.
The blue and one, and if you don't have the blue one, and if you have
exactly. So, we, in order to function in the culture, we have to deal with these things. The question is then, how not to become identified with that and to live, experience the reality of things as they are, without being blinded by all of this other stuff. Because that's what, you know, it's like the ant in the sugar bowl. It's just become completely intoxicated and blinded and knows nothing else. And so, of course, yes, governments are created, you know, systems of economic systems, and it's all created from this perspective of identification and separation.
So there's just, I'm laughing because I'm thinking of the recensement that we had, and I got so puzzled because I had to answer all those questions, and like very simple questions, but I have really had problems, like, you know, even like the, it starts with, do you live in a house or an apartment? And with my house, I live around the block, it's not really a house, but it's not really an apartment either. So I was like, what do I tick? And then they said, how many rooms do you have? So I was like, well, yeah, I have open spaces. What do I count? So I was like, I really had problems ticking all the boxes, but it's really...
And so then we have to compromise.
And you have to do something. I was like, well, whatever, you know, okay, I'll say it's an apartment. And I say, you know, I'll pretend that there's a wall here. So I put like X number of rooms.
Right. So, that, what do we do then? What do we do?
But it's true that there is a contradiction between, as you said, like blinded. That speaks to me. Like not being blinded by that culture, that environment that pushes us to identify ourselves with something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a clear... Yeah, clear contradiction. And it's becoming worse when there's violence that is involved in it.
Because the whole thing is violent, whether it's expressed in, you know, like people going into schools and shooting up or shooting people, or whether it's just on a daily basis of discrimination. You know, the schools are not integrated or whatever. You know, the whole thing is it's a violence because it's going against the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality of things as they are, which are it's diversity and oneness. It's both. You know. We're all one, and yet we are all different. Like Bernie Glassman says, the only thing we share is our differences, ultimately. But we share the fact that we're different, which is a fabulous thing, you know? And then, yeah, we try to impose how we think things. You know, we're living out of projections and fantasies and greed, anger, and ignorance. And so then, therefore, we're going to try to impose on these people who want to live on the land that they feel is their land for, you know, ancestral, and we want to put a pipeline through it because we want the oil, you know. So it's that action is coming from a position of greed and not seeing things as they are, and the whole environmental, you know, let's not even go there, you know, and what we're doing with the environment, so. Yeah. But the place to start is here. With each one starts here. And it makes a difference. It makes a difference in the way you experience the world, yourself, and then the way that you relate with others, and the way that the actions then you take in the world are different too. Because there is an awareness of things as they are. And therefore, we don't behave the same way with things, with ourselves, with others.
Could this be where the idea of non-attachment comes in? Because if we don't attach ourselves to that, who identify what we identify with, is that
exactly? Yeah. Because and that's what we do. Yeah, we attach ourselves to that. We hang on to that identity so fiercely, because we feel if we don't, you know, the sometimes we talk about the little self and the big self. And the little self feels threatened because it needs to have those identity. That identity has to hang on to that for dear life, because it thinks that if it lets go of that, it will not exist anymore. Which, in fact, is true. In a sense, because there's actually not two selves. You know, it's like the thing with Confucius. The second one begins when we see there's only one, but it's just a different aspect of it. But yeah, it's true. Absolutely. And the non-attachment, that's one of the biggest misconceptions, misunderstandings of when people talk about Buddhism or Zen, is non-attachment. Because it doesn't mean poor and destitute, not caring about anything. Not at all. We actually care more. You know? Yeah.
It doesn't mean not belonging either.
No,
yeah,
absolutely not.
It doesn't mean also no self.
No.
As Stephen Batchelor said,
that's right.
Nothing's wrong with the self.
No, absolutely. Not at all. But because language is so much about division and duality and separation, we have to use it in a certain way by saying no self. That's why Zen always talks about no effort, no self, no thought. Because if you say thought, that means something. If you say not thinking, that means something. We're staying in the dualities. And so Zen chooses this non-attachment, non-thought, no self, etc. But it doesn't mean not. It's not nihilistic in that sense.
It really feels, I'm struck how it's pulling the, I mean, once we get there, it's pulling the rug out of our feet, but like not individually, also from the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
The whole system. I mean, it's like you cannot, it's very difficult to think about it in terms of expending it to the the world, I mean socially, it's like then there's no, like the notion of private property, the notion of nationality, the notion of having a passport, border. I mean, it's like, it's the foundation of the whole system, economic, social system.
Mm-hmm. And there is something underlying all of that that is reasonable. You know, so that we can function together.
It's always existed.
We need it.
Absolutely. Always been
there always has been. And for necessary reasons. Necessary
schemes.
Reasons. In order to function as a civilized society, we need to have things like that, right? The point then is, okay, so we do this, but what is the way to do it without emphasizing division rather than inclusion? Exclusion rather than inclusion, and how can we best do it without being blinded and giving in to the forces of greed, anger, and ignorance. From my experience has been that realizing the self and the true self is the answer. And that changes then how I function. And that's the only place I can really do anything, is how I feel and function. It's changed my life. And as Bernie Glassman says, well, when people say, yeah, but I can't take any action now because I'm not awakened, and it's too big, where do I begin? And he's always saying, well, you just start where you are. You know, you start in your household. You start with your neighbor. You start with, I cannot resolve the refugee and the migrant crisis that we're experiencing. So the only thing I can do is I just go to the place that is nearest to me and do what I can for those people. I can't do anything else, but it doesn't matter if I can do anything else. Because I am in my situation addressing this issue of exclusion, inequality, war, terrorism, all of that. It's not going to change anything, really. But it does change, for the guy whose laundry I did, it changes everything. Or the guy who I talked to while we're having a tea, you know, changes everything.
I mean, yet if you think of it on the global scale, or larger scale, and think, okay, based on my understanding, what would be the political, the proper political organization, and like, for example, okay, well, maybe that notion of border is absurd, and maybe we should militer in order to have like a no passport, or like just a global passport, or whatever, you know, like the action that we could take, or maybe like a fantasy, but maybe, I don't know, we could have a political movement that says, okay, there's no border, we shouldn't have any border anymore, or borders exist, but we should be able to anybody should be able to travel anywhere in the world, for example. I mean, on a global, I'm thinking, if you pull the strings, like you draw the consequences of that understanding on a larger scale, and think, okay, maybe on a political global level, that should be done.
But there are organizations that work on this.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's
you can be active in these organizations just by supporting them. Or
there's all kinds of
signing
petitions
or campaigns. There are tons of organizations.
So the question is, which do you choose?
Exactly.
What is
right, exactly.
Where
yeah.
You
so
put
it's
your
like,
time. So it might be working
right.
with a migrant. It might be doing what I
right.
do with Oxfam. It might be a lot of stuff.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There are. It's just
I'm
it
like,
at your level, and you do it in what
right.
is most intimate for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
there
what
are
is
tons of
exactly? And what is
and
what,
they're not Buddhist,
what makes
they're
sense
not,
for
just,
you?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's just a question
yeah.
of
what
making
makes
sense
for
you.
Because I don't know that sense of like when you draw the consequences of that understanding is just in terms of the world.
It's
like it's the foundations of of our organization?
Well, of being, you know, because it's not only on a, you know, macro level, but it's on an individual level. I personally see so much suffering around me that arises from this sense that people don't have of who they truly are, you know, and they're trying so hard to be something, to accomplish something, and they're, you know, turning to all kinds of misguided, problematic things that could just generate suffering in their lives. And, you know, that's why I do this here, is okay, so I make this practice available if someone wants it. Because this is how I have seen that something can change for people in their lives. There's lots of people doing, you know, other practices, you know, doing other things, trying to help people with suffering. This is not the only way. But the question is, so what do we do then? What do we live our lives from this position of seeing things as they are in the reality of life? Or do we, and then do we therefore act in order from that position? Or do we act from a position of separation? And, oh, it's time to go ahead. Creating more suffering, you know? So, okay, we have to go. I have to.